Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Tides of History early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts.
The hammering of picks and scraping of shovels melded with the boom of artillery, the sharp cracks of handguns, and dull thuds as cannonballs impacted earth and stone. Laborers sweated under the heat of the summer sun, digging out trenches, artillery emplacements, and tunnels. Gunners heaved their cannon back into position after a shot, rolled heavy barrels of gunpowder, and hefted iron and stone cannonballs and explosive shells, grunting and shouting with the effort. Janissaries, in their distinctive, folded-over caps, rested their arquebuses on rocks and the earthen embankments of siege works. They sighted down the barrels, picked out targets on the walls, took aim, and carefully squeezed the triggers. Sieges were noisy affairs, particularly when the will of the Sultan turned all the tremendous might of the Ottoman Empire toward the task. Their target was worthy of the attention here in September of 1522, The Fortress of Rhodes loomed ahead, a massive and imposing edifice, a series of high, thick walls studded with bastions, deep stone-lined ditches to trap attackers, and cannon of their own booming back at those attackers. Silent and impassive, his slim face shaded by an enormous white turban, a man watched the proceedings with calculated interest. The late summer heat bore down, the rays of the Mediterranean sun causing a slight trickle of sweat to run down his back under his elaborately embroidered robes. The man turned and entered the cooler confines of an elaborate red tent, where a crowd of officials, viziers, and soldiers hung on his every word. He was young, still in his 20s, but there was no doubt as to who was in charge. Command came easily to him, and his word was iron. If he wanted an assault, his janissaries would throw themselves at the defenses. If he wanted a mine placed under the walls, the laborers would dig and dig and dig. Suleiman, ruler of the Ottoman Empire, knew what he wanted. He wanted the island fortress of Rhodes, just a few miles off the Aegean coast of Anatolia, a tiny but dangerous dagger aimed directly at the heart of his empire. And he was willing to expend thousands of lives and untold resources to get it. Banners waved defiantly from the walls, visible from the Sultan's throne inside his red tent. 8 pointed white crosses on a red background, the emblem of the Hospitaller Knights, the piratical remnants of the Crusades who ruled Rhodes. He would have their fortress and their heads, the Sultan thought, no matter the cost. The Ottoman Empire reached its apogee during Suleiman's 46-year reign. His armies marched from the Persian Gulf to the Danube. His fleets plied the Red Sea, the Indian Ocean, and the western reaches of the Mediterranean. He ruled the most powerful state in Europe and Western Asia, the envy and terror of all his contemporaries. Truly, he was Suleiman the Magnificent. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. The Ottoman Empire was the superpower of the 15th and 16th centuries. Starting in a small, out-of-the-way corner at the westernmost tip of Asia, its rulers conquered Anatolia, the Balkans, and the great city of Constantinople itself. The descendants of Osman built a state with a powerful standing army, cutting-edge military technology, an effective bureaucracy, and resources on a scale that dwarfed their contemporaries and competitors. By the time of Sultan Selim the Grim's death in 1520, the Ottomans were threatening the heart of Christendom in Europe while simultaneously emerging as the preeminent power in the Muslim world, the protectors of the pilgrimage routes to Mecca and Medina. But the highest points were still yet to come. Under the rule of Selim's son, Suleiman, the Ottoman Empire grew to stretch from the Persian Gulf to the gates of Vienna, from the narrow gorges of the Upper Nile River to the open grasslands of the Black Sea steppe. No other state, even in an era of rising states, could rival the Ottomans. No ruler could stand in comparison to Suleiman the Magnificent, the Grand Turk. In today's episode and the one that follows, we're going to explore both Suleiman himself and the state he ruled. Even more than that, we're going to try to understand why, for so long, Suleiman's reign has seemed like an Ottoman golden age, the apex of the empire. After Suleiman, the old narrative of Ottoman history goes, everything slowly but surely declined. By the 19th century, the Ottoman Empire was the sick man of Europe, backwards and indebted, the pathetic plaything of the vigorous great powers, surviving only at the sufferance of foreign bankers and diplomats. According to this line of thinking, the Ottoman Empire suffered a long, slow, inevitable death, one that had been in the making since Suleiman the Magnificent breathed his last. This is a powerful story, one that's influenced generations of historians and the popular image of the Ottoman Empire. It's also straightforwardly wrong. The Ottomans were a first-rate power up to at least the end of the 17th century and even well into the 18th. The Ottoman Empire did change after Suleiman's reign, not always for the better, but change didn't have to be bad. It was usually necessary, a response to shifting economic and social circumstances and the state's changing needs. But to Ottoman commentators of the 17th century, many of them on the wrong end of these changes or simply resistant to them, all change looked like a decline. Once the empire's trajectory became obvious, with the end either in sight or finally past, it wasn't hard to turn its whole story into a drawn-out process of deterioration from the highs of Suleiman's reign. It's easy to say that the Ottoman decline thesis, as it's called, is wrong. That's because it is. But it's also a little more complicated than that. Suleiman's reign was full of achievements. He himself was a much more imposing figure than his successors. The later sultans paled by comparison. More importantly, Suleiman's reign did mark both a high point and a turning point. The end of the first phase of Ottoman history, the expansive phase, and the beginning of the second, of consolidation and stable rule. This was, in fact, a major transformation, and it encompassed a whole bunch of different things, from the precise role of the sultan to the goals and conduct of military campaigns. If we're not careful and precise, this can indeed seem like decline. But the times, they were a-changing, and it's the changing times we're going to try to understand through Suleiman and what he did. So let's start by reacquainting ourselves with precisely what was going on in the Ottoman Empire when Suleiman succeeded his father in 1520. Selim the Grim had ruled for only 8 years, from 1512 to 1520, but he'd gotten a lot done in that brief span of time, eliminating every other contender for the Ottoman throne in bloody fashion, conquering Syria, the Levant, and Egypt, and destroying the Mamluks, and crushing the religious extremist Safavids of Iran. At the time of his death, Selim had been turning his attention from the Muslim world back toward Christendom. If he'd survived longer, it's a safe bet that the warmongering Selim would have taken his armies deep into Christian Europe. A carpet is large enough to accommodate two Sufis, Selim wrote in one of his pieces of Persian poetry, but the world is not large enough for two kings. That was the fear dominating the mind of every power broker in the West. Selim landing on the shores of southern Italy at the head of 100,000 men, finishing what his grandfather, Mehmet II, had left undone at his death in 1481, or Selim leading his great train of siege guns and disciplined Janissaries up the Danube to Vienna and beyond. With the conquest of Egypt and the humbling of the Safavids behind him, it all seemed plausible, even likely, for Selim the Grim. But instead, quite unexpectedly, Selim died, aged just 49. The cause of death is unclear. Maybe cancer, maybe poison, maybe plague. We have no real idea. Suleiman was just 25 years old when he came to the throne, soon to turn 26. He was also, and this is essential to bear in mind, Selim's only viable male heir. Selim had prepared Suleiman to rule since childhood. He grew up in the palace in Istanbul, where he received a fine and well-rounded education in everything from poetry to the Quran to military matters. After that, Suleiman went out into the world, first to northwestern Anatolia, near Istanbul, where his grandfather Bayezid used him as a pawn in the ongoing struggle between Selim and his brothers for the throne, then to Kaffa in the Crimea, where Suleiman kept his father safe at his lowest point during the civil wars, then back to Istanbul and Edirne as the city's governors. And now, finally, to Manisa in western Anatolia, a key strategic province on the blue waters of the Aegean. It was in Manisa that word of Selim's death reached Suleiman. Prudently, he waited a few days to be sure it was true. His father had been a suspicious and cruel man, and Suleiman feared that the report of his death was a ruse to draw his son into open rebellion, as Selim had rebelled against his father. When it became clear that Selim was in fact dead, Suleiman headed to Istanbul to take his place as sultan. A Venetian envoy, Bartolomeo Contarini, wrote a description of the new sultan from just after his accession. Suleiman was, quote, tall but wiry and of delicate complexion. His neck is a little too long, his face thin, and his nose aquiline. He has the shadow of a mustache and a small beard. Nevertheless, he has a pleasant mien, though his skin tends toward pallor. He is said to be a wise lord, fond of study, and all men hope for good from his rule. Suleiman was not his father. Selim was agreed by all to be a cruel warmonger with an insatiable lust for conquest. But the young sultan looked at the world with a cool, calm, studied gaze. The whole Christian West breathed a deep sigh of relief. The Italian churchman Paolo Giovio expressed a widespread sentiment when Suleiman succeeded his father. Quote, it seemed to all men that a gentle lamb had succeeded a fierce lion. Since Suleiman himself was but young and of no experience, and altogether given to rest and quietness. As we shall see, this feeling was deeply misguided. Remember, the moment of greatest weakness and instability for the Ottoman Empire was when the Sultan died. Unigeniture was the rule, and any son or grandson could stake his claim to the throne. It was survival of the fittest. Intrigue, assassination, poisoning, murder, open civil war. All of these things preceded and accompanied the death of the ruler. But Selim had made a clean sweep of all his close relatives. He killed his brothers, his nephews, anybody else with a claim on the throne. If Suleiman had ever had any brothers, Selim had long since gotten rid of them. Suleiman was the only one left, and he was skilled, intelligent, and prepared to rule. Instead of spending years consolidating his hold on the throne, as Selim and Bayezid had done, he could, like his great-grandfather Mehmet the Conqueror had done with Constantinople, jump straight into the business of ruling. Suleiman wasted no time. He was not his father, and made that clear in a few different ways. He released some Egyptian notables who'd been deported to Istanbul after Selim's conquest. Traders whose activities in Persia had been restricted were allowed to go about their business. Many of Selim's favorite officials had been unpopular, even brutal. The Kapudan Pasha, or chief admiral, Kafer Bey, had earned the nickname the Bloodthirsty for his many acts of cruelty, and Suleiman promptly ordered Kafer Bey's public execution. Justice was Suleiman's overriding concern, or at least that's how he wanted to be seen. My sublime commandment, he wrote to the governor of Egypt soon after taking the throne, as inescapable and binding as fate, is that rich and poor, town and country, subjects and tribute payers, everyone must hasten to obey you. If some are slow to accomplish the duty, be they emirs or fakirs, do not hesitate to inflict on them the ultimate punishment. There was an implicit rebuke of Selim's capriciousness and viciousness in that statement. Everyone would be subject to the same standard of justice. Even so, all was not perfectly smooth. A rebellion broke out in Syria, which was quickly put down, without the need for Suleiman's personal involvement. But all of that was small potatoes, a sideshow compared to the main event. As tradition dictated, Suleiman paid off the Janissaries, giving them each 3,000 akçe, equivalent to about 55 ducats. That was a year and a half's pay for a Spanish infantryman, or more than a year's wages for a lansknecht. On top of that, Suleiman increased the Janissaries' regular wages. If you wanted to keep soldiers happy in fighting, keeping them paid was a good way to start. And Suleiman would want to fight very soon. The new sultan took the throne in September of 1520. By early winter, preparations were underway for a major campaign. The target was Belgrade, now the capital of Serbia, but in 1521, it was the southern bastion of the Kingdom of Hungary. The Hungarians and Ottomans had been fighting off and on for more than a century. There had been Hungarian crusaders at Nicopolis in 1396 and at Varna in 1444. Mehmed the Conqueror had spent much of his reign fighting the capable Hungarian king Matthias Corvinus, one of the most powerful and gifted rulers of the age. But by 1520, there was no Matthias Corvinus sitting on the Hungarian throne. Instead, its occupant was a weak and ineffectual young man by the name of Louis II. His nobles were at each other's throats, fiercely protective of their independence and unwilling to rally around their 14-year-old king even in the face of the Ottoman threat. Suleiman used either the death or the mutilation of an ambassador, it's not entirely clear which, as a pretext for war. Soon, the full might of the Ottomans turned toward Belgrade. The Hungarians put up little resistance. Where Mehmed II had fought a desperate battle outside the city in 1456, nearly dying at the hands of a Hungarian relief force, Belgrade fell to Suleiman with ease in August of 1521. The Hungarians and the garrison were massacred. The Serbs were exiled hundreds of miles away. The door to Central Europe had swung open. It would be a few years longer before Suleiman would walk through that open, inviting gateway, with disastrous consequences for Hungary and Christendom.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Takeoff 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Suleiman was just getting started. Belgrade had been a major undertaking involving tens of thousands of soldiers operating far away from the Ottoman heartland. But the Sultan had his eye on yet another target that had eluded his conquering great-grandfather Mehmed. The island of Rhodes, home and headquarters of the Hospitaller Knights. The Knights had taken up residence on Rhodes, just off the southwestern coast of Anatolia in the Aegean, after the fall of the Holy Land to the Mamluks in the 13th century. Since then, the Knights had occupied themselves with a mixture of piracy and politicking from their island base. Galleys rowed by captured Muslim slaves and crewed by the flower of Christian Europe's nobility raided the pilgrimage routes to Mecca and the lifelines of trade linking Istanbul to Egypt, the Levant, and North Africa. Seaborne holy war for glory and profit made the Hospitallers famous and wealthy. More seriously, the Knights interfered in Ottoman politics whenever possible. Prince Cem had fled to the Knights' protection when trying to escape his brother, Sultan Bayezid, back in the 1480s, just after Mehmet's failed siege of the island. Located in the heart of the Aegean, smack dab in the middle of an Ottoman sea, the Knights were a thorn in the side of the Ottomans in particular and the Muslim world more generally. Getting rid of them would reinforce Ottoman claims to being the protectors of the Muslim world. Suleiman was determined to deal with them. But that was easier said than done. Mehmet had expended enormous resources trying to take Rhodes back in 1480 and still come up short, at the cost of thousands of lives and huge amounts of money. Suleiman took it a step further. He must have begun preparing this next campaign just after returning to Istanbul from Belgrade, or, more likely, even while it was still ongoing. When Suleiman arrived on Rhodes in July of 1522, accompanied by somewhere around 50,000 fighting men and at least that many conscripted laborers,
The Sultan looked up from the shore at an imposing fortress that loomed over the Ottoman invaders. It had been a serious obstacle in 1480 when it repelled Mehmet the Conqueror, and it had only gotten more daunting in the years since. The knights had no shortage of money or expertise in the art of defense. The result was a multi-layered defensive system that presented a series of obstacles to the attackers, built by generation after generation of talented, skilled, and well-provisioned military architects. The art of fortification was evolving quickly in this age. That was the essence of the military revolution we've talked so much about here on Tides. But the Knights' Stronghold represented some of the most advanced defenses of the time. The main wall had been thickened to resist cannon fire. It was now 12 meters thick in some places, and it was rounded at the top to support artillery of its own. Menacing towers, some rectangular and others rounded, shot upward toward the sky. Loopholes and machicolations, outward projections that allowed defenders to shoot down at anybody at the foot of the wall, studded the thick main line of defense. But the main wall was just the icing on the cake. The real defenses lay outward. A second, lower wall, itself studded with more loopholes and cannon, arrowhead-shaped bastions projecting from those two walls that allowed defenders to fire along its length and rake attackers with cannon and gunfire. A dry, wide ditch, its vertical outer face 20 feet tall and lined with stone that protected the main walls and towers from bombardment. And a second, outer ditch, a bit shallower to slow attackers before they got anywhere close to the main system of fortifications. The depth of the ditches made it hard for the besiegers to get clean shots at the walls, and even if they did, the walls were so thick and reinforced with earth that they couldn't be brought down even with sustained gunfire. An infantry assault would have to cross the outer ditch, climbing down and then up, go across a wide, flat embankment cleared for fire, then climb down 20 feet into the second stone-lined ditch. Then they'd be looking up at sheer walls 30 feet high with outward bastions and bulwarks. The whole time, they'd be under arrow, cannon, and gunfire from the defenders on the walls. Rhodes was designed to be a death trap. Even if the defenders were vastly outnumbered, a number maybe 2,500 men in the fortress, including 600 of the elite Hospitaller knights, they could break the attackers on the walls. None of this was a mystery to Suleiman when he arrived on Rhodes. His spies, and he had many, had kept the Sultan well informed about the state of the defenses and the soldiers manning them. Yet he had decided to come anyway. There's no better encapsulation of both Suleiman and the empire he ruled than the decision to confront the knights in their stronghold to spend whatever treasure and blood were necessary to accomplish the Sultan's goal. The result was a grinding, brutal, 145-day-long bloodbath. I believe verily that since the creation of the world, such artillery and so great quantity was never laid before any town as hath been against Rhodes in this siege, wrote a French knight in the fortress. The Ottoman cannon roared incessantly, sending stone and iron balls to crash against the walls to little effect. Gangs of conscripted laborers painstakingly dug trenches through the thin, rocky soil. Mines tunneled under the walls were more effective. They were filled with gunpowder and detonated, opening a breach 12 yards wide. 12 yards wasn't wide enough. The mass attack the Ottomans launched floundered in the ditches and the rubble of the breach, leaving hundreds or thousands of corpses behind. And that was just one attack. The constant gunfire and sniping cost the Ottomans many more lives. On and on the siege went, stretching into the dismal winter months. Assault after assault failed, swept from the walls and the ditch by the incessant flanking gunfire from the bastions and bulwarks. By November 30th, the day of the last major failed attack, the Ottomans had lost tens of thousands of dead. More than half their force was gone. But the defenders were in worse shape. Their gunpowder was almost exhausted. It was time for the two sides to talk. After a month of back-and-forth negotiation, Suleiman and the Grand Master of the Knights, Philippe de Villiers de l'Isle-Adam, came to an agreement. The Knights would depart Rhodes unmolested, with their property and even their guns, using Suleiman's ships if necessary. On December 26th, Suleiman and the Grand Master came face to face, the Sultan in his great white turban and the elderly knight in his gleaming armor. The deal was done. And on January 1st, 1523, The knights boarded their ships and sailed away. The Siege of Rhodes was a costly and miserable endeavor that cost tens of thousands of lives and huge quantities of money. It was even enough to tap out the usually overflowing coffers of the Ottoman Empire. 1522-3 was a year of budget deficits, an extreme rarity in an age of almost constant surpluses. But Suleiman had won. No other ruler in Europe could have done anything like this, bringing together both a force of that size and the logistical muscle necessary to keep it supplied and fighting on a tiny island in the face of enormous casualties and difficulties. This was what made the Ottomans special compared to their peers, and Suleiman had the will to wield the power of this enormous empire for the most ambitious possible purposes. Even the mighty Suleiman occasionally needed a breather, though. For the next several years, internal concerns dominated the Sultan's agenda. Rebellions in Egypt, unrest in Syria, and most serious, a major disturbance among the Janissaries. It was always dangerous for Ottoman rulers to take too much time between campaigns. 2 years, 1523 and 1524 without one, and no plans for another in 1525, made the Janissaries restless. No campaigns meant no bonuses and no plunder, and too much time to sit around the barracks plotting and planning. When the Janissaries rose up, ransacking the palaces of powerful officials, and even threatening Suleiman himself, the Sultan killed several men with his own hands. He had the agas, commanders of the Janissaries and the household sipahis, executed, but he also paid out large bonuses to the rank and file to keep them in line. That still wasn't enough, though. Suleiman knew he would need a campaign, a major one, to quell the unrest. The most viable target was young King Louis II of Hungary. The atmosphere between the Ottomans and the Hungarians had remained tense in the years since the capture of Belgrade. Border raids and slaving expeditions were common occurrences. And Hungary was no less divided than it had been 5 years before. If anything, its nobles were even more at each other's throats, as it grew clearer and clearer that King Louis couldn't offer effective leadership. This made Hungary a ripe fruit to be plucked. With Louis's marriage to Mary, the sister of the Holy Roman Emperor, Charles V, a blow against Hungary would likewise be a blow against the Habsburg dynasty, the true rivals of Suleiman and the Ottomans. Beyond that, conquering Hungary would open up the entirety of Central Europe, from Austria to Bohemia to Poland, to Ottoman raiding and eventually conquest. Suleiman left Istanbul on April 21, 1526, at the head of around 50,000 men and several hundred cannon. The Ottomans advanced slowly and methodically, taking a few fortresses as they progressed along the Danube before entering the wide, inviting plain of Hungary. King Louis was waiting for them with an army on the field of Mohács, 125 miles south down the Danube from the Hungarian capital of Buda. Louis had begged his fellow European rulers for aid against the looming Ottoman threat. None had been forthcoming, not even from his brothers-in-law, Charles, the Holy Roman Emperor, and Ferdinand, the Archduke of Austria. The Hungarian nobility was unwilling to put aside its quarreling long enough to even mount a unified response. The result was an undermanned army facing the invading Ottomans at Mohács. Perhaps 25,000 men, or about half of what Suleiman had brought to the field. The Ottomans arrived late in the day, facing a Hungarian army ready for battle on a low rise beyond the plain. Suleiman's forces took their time in deploying, figuring that the Hungarians wouldn't attack as afternoon rolled around on August 28th of 1526. The first division of the Ottoman army was in the process of pitching their tents on the field when a wave of Hungarians, heavily armored men-at-arms on horseback, crashed into their lines and drove them back in disarray. It was a promising start for the Hungarians. If they could face the Ottomans in detail as they marched onto the field, then their lack of numbers and the Ottoman superiority in artillery and handguns wouldn't be an insurmountable problem. The Ottoman 1st Division retreated in disorder, streaming back up a muddy, gentle slope on which the rest of the Ottoman army was preparing for battle. Suleiman himself led the second group, thousands of arquebus-armed Janissaries waiting behind makeshift field fortifications, hundreds of cannon ready to fire. They poured volley after volley into the Hungarian men-at-arms, arquebus shot and iron cannonballs punching through men and horses and stopping most of their potent charge in its tracks. Only a small group was able to break through, making for the distinctive figure of Suleiman himself. They got close enough for their lances to glance off Suleiman's armor before his Janissary bodyguards hamstrung their horses with their pole arms, dragged them to the ground, and killed them. Behind the heavy cavalry, the Hungarian infantry, many of them experienced German and Polish mercenaries who knew how to fight the Ottomans, advanced across the plain. But they were too slow to exploit the shock of the initial charge. By the time they arrived, after eating gunfire the whole way, the Ottomans had extended their line to surround the beleaguered Hungarians. The men-at-arms and infantry were trapped. They fought hard, nearly to the bitter end. Only a few men-at-arms, including King Louis himself, managed to escape the tightening cordon. Louis probably drowned trying to cross a flooded ditch, an ignominious end for the King of Hungary. The Ottomans took some 2,000 prisoners, but most of the Hungarian army, probably 20,000 men in total, died where they stood. It was a crushing victory, one of the most complete and decisive in any age. Suleiman pitched his elaborately decorated red tent on the battlefield and watched as his Janissaries paraded the prisoners past, then beheaded them, piling their heads in pyramids and sticking those of the most prominent Hungarians on sharp pikes. Suleiman's daily journal emphasized his ongoing dislike of the torrential rain that soaked the Hungarian plain every bit as much as the execution of thousands of prisoners. The Ottomans had been mauled themselves, and there was still some fear that another Hungarian force was lying in wait for them. So they waited on the battlefield for a few days before moving on. Buda, the Hungarian capital, lay 125 miles to the north. It fell without resistance, and practically all of Hungary now belonged to Suleiman. The route into Central Europe was now completely open to the Ottomans, should they choose to exploit it.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/youknowbusiness.
In fact, Suleiman didn't immediately try to force his way deeper into Central Europe. It was a long way from Istanbul in the center of Ottoman power, at the very limits of operational range. Besides, the Sultan had a perfectly good puppet candidate for the throne of Hungary, a guy named John Zápolya. Much of the Hungarian nobility supported Zápolya's bid. It was always easier to control a territory through an intermediary than to try to take it over completely. The problem here lay in the other claimant to the Hungarian throne. As I mentioned a little while ago, prior to his untimely death in the mud, Louis II of Hungary had been married to Mary. Now, Mary was the sister of the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V and Ferdinand, Archduke of Austria, which made her a member of the Habsburg dynasty. Part of the marriage agreement between Mary and Louis II had been that if Louis died without an heir, Ferdinand would inherit his claim to the crown of Hungary. Now, this wasn't strictly legal. The Hungarian monarchy had a strong elective element, meaning that the nobility was supposed to have a major say in who succeeded to the throne. But what mattered in this period of dynastic politics was less the strict legality of the claim than the fact that the claim existed at all. If the claim existed, then military muscle, financial might, and good old-fashioned politicking would decide whether the claim was accepted, not the strict legalities of the matter. Any sort of claim in Habsburg hands, as we've seen many times here on Tides, was a dangerous weapon. Ferdinand, in classic Habsburg fashion, wasted no time in pressing his claim, sending a potent mercenary army into Hungary that easily put John Zápolya to flight. The Hungarian nobles, sensing which way the wind was blowing, threw their support behind Ferdinand. Suleiman was nobody's fool, and neither were the Habsburgs, either Ferdinand or his powerful brother Charles. Both understood that the other was the real rival and threat. With Ferdinand emerging victorious in Hungary, the powerful Habsburgs would be right on the Ottoman borders. It took a few years for this inevitable conflict to fully blossom. But when it did, the consequences would be enormous. John Zápolyá sent emissaries to secure explicit Ottoman support against Ferdinand. Ferdinand, for his part, sent his own envoys to try to negotiate a truce or settlement with Suleiman. Zápolyá's ambassadors were more effective. In their last audience, Suleiman gave Ferdinand's envoys a menacing message. Quote, "Your lord has not yet experienced our friendship and our proximity, but he shall feel them soon. Warn him, therefore, to have everything ready to receive me well." In May of 1529, Suleiman set out from Istanbul leading an enormous force. Somewhere around 75,000 fighting men, plus 300 pieces of artillery, and thousands more laborers and camp followers. This imposing expedition's target was the heart of Ferdinand's realm, a direct challenge to the power of the Habsburgs, and a statement of intention about their relationship in the future. The destination was Vienna. But almost from the beginning, things didn't go according to plan. Suleiman always hated the rain. He complained about it constantly. In the spring and early summer of 1529, it came down in torrents. The roads through the Balkans turned to muck and mire, bogging down the heavy siege guns. Floods washed away bridges. The pace of advance slowed to a crawl. They were already operating on a tight window if they hoped to make a proper siege of Vienna. But the army was delayed a month. They didn't arrive outside the city until September 27th. The Ottomans also arrived without the heavy artillery that would have allowed them to effectively bombard the walls and open breaches for assault. As usual, Christian Europe had dithered and quarreled in the face of the Ottoman threat, and it presented nothing like a united front. Still, Vienna was hardly defenseless. Its walls had been thickened and strengthened, fields of fire cleared for the guns on the walls. The garrison was formidable and included thousands of experienced German Lanzknecht mercenaries and battle-hardened Spanish arquebusiers fresh from the wars in Italy. Maintaining the siege over the winter this far from the core Ottoman territories was completely out of the question, unlike Rhodes 7 years earlier. With only a few weeks remaining before bad weather set in and put an end to the campaigning season, the Ottomans would have to move quickly and effectively. Nothing went right. The small guns the Ottomans had available couldn't dent the walls, so they turned to mining. They succeeded in opening up small breaches, but their assaults made no headway against a determined defense. Even the promise of huge cash rewards for the Janissaries if they could penetrate the city failed to produce results. By mid-October, the snow was falling in great drifts, burying the besiegers. On October 16th, Suleiman decided to turn around and head for home. For the first time in his reign, he had failed, truly failed, to accomplish his goal. Christian Europe rejoiced, saved from the Ottoman menace. At least for now. For the moment, the Habsburgs were safe. The Sultan made another attempt on Vienna in 1532, but he got held up with the siege of a key fortress and decided to ravage the Austrian countryside in an attempt to draw Charles V out from behind the city's walls into a pitched battle. Suleiman wanted to meet the emperor in person, to settle their quarrel on the battlefield, but Charles had no desire to do so. As we'll see in the coming months here on Tides, we're going to do two episodes on Charles V. Charles was many things. He sometimes miscalculated, but he wasn't the kind of fool who would abandon a strongly fortified position to risk a battle against the finest army of the day for the sake of mere imperial prestige. The 1532 campaign caused great destruction but went nowhere of note. Vienna was once again secure. For the moment, neither Charles, and he was the real power, not his brother Ferdinand, despite Ferdinand's Hungarian crown, nor Suleiman really wanted to continue the war. Charles was busy in Italy, with his constant, ongoing war against Francis I of France. Suleiman was growing concerned with Persia in the east. He saw the rich prize of Baghdad as ripe for the plucking. A truce was in the temporary interest of both sides. Charles and Ferdinand got nothing much, aside from a breather, and Suleiman and his officials were openly contemptuous. The Ottoman Grand Vizier Ibrahim Pasha said of Charles, quote, "He," meaning the emperor, "has talked of fighting us, of compelling the Lutherans to convert, but it has all remained a dead letter. It is not worthy of an emperor to undertake something and not accomplish it, to talk but do nothing." And so Suleiman turned his attention toward the east. In 1533, Using the defection and then assassination of the Safavid governor of Baghdad as a pretext, the Ottomans launched a major campaign against Persia. They took key fortresses along the border, and then captured Tabriz, the Safavid capital, but without much resistance. The Ottomans couldn't bring the Safavids to battle, and the Safavids remembered what had happened at Chaldiran in 1514. Why fight the Ottomans in the open when you could simply scorch the earth, retreat, and wait for them to run out of food? The mountainous and difficult terrain of what's now eastern Turkey, northern Iraq, and Azerbaijan made it hard to move, much less conduct effective operations, and the Ottomans struggled to hold on to much territory. Still, they took Aleppo, and then late in 1534, grabbed a hold of Baghdad itself. Baghdad had fallen far from its glory days under the Abbasid Caliphate. The Mongol sack of 1258 had killed hundreds of thousands and laid waste to the city, and Tamerlane had done terrible things there in his time. But Baghdad was still a major commercial and political center. It was the key to controlling Mesopotamia, what's now Iraq. Even more than that, this was a major ideological victory. Controlling Baghdad was yet another sign of Ottoman preeminence in the Muslim world. The treaty with the Safavids that ended this war confirmed Ottoman possession of this whole region as far as the Persian Gulf. The Ottomans were now a power in the Red Sea, even the Indian Ocean, soon to launch their own age of exploration, something we'll discuss further in next week's episode. Yet now, once again, Ottoman attention swung back to the west. The conflict with the Habsburgs was far from over, but the theater shifted from Central Europe to North Africa. Since the reign of Selim the Grim, the Ottomans had retained interests in North Africa, accepting the vassalage and alliance of the Barbary Corsairs. The Barbarossa brothers, first Oruç and then the far more capable Hayreddin, had been the linchpin of Ottoman strategy in the region, key allies. The Barbarossas had been fighting an off-and-on war with Charles and the Spanish for decades. Over the years, Hayreddin grew closer and closer to the Ottomans, eventually entering Istanbul with a large fleet and receiving the appointment of Kapudan Pasha, Grand Admiral of the Ottoman Navy. With his new commission in hand, Hayreddin set off to ravage the coast of Italy in 1533, burning towns, butchering villagers, and taking thousands of slaves. If that wasn't enough, Hayreddin already held the key port of Algiers, which he had taken from the Spanish in 1529. With Ottoman support, he now captured the even more important port of Tunis from its Muslim overlord in 1534. From Tunis, close to the site of ancient Carthage, Barbarossa could threaten Charles V's possessions in Sicily and Naples. A fleet of corsairs could leave Tunis on a Sunday, sack towns in Sicily on Tuesday, and threaten Rome itself on Friday, returning safely to their home port 4 or 5 days later. Charles V couldn't accept that. What made all of this even more worrisome was the fact that his two great enemies, Suleiman and King Francis I of France, were now in constant diplomatic contact. A full-blown alliance, with all the strategic coordination against Charles's dispersed territories that implied, was in the offing, though it'd be a few years before it bore fruit. Suleiman could advance to Vienna while his corsairs attacked Sicily and Naples, and Francis I invaded the Rhineland, Milan, or Catalonia. Even for a ruler as wealthy and powerful as Charles, that would be too much to handle, too many fronts to fight on at once. Something had to be done. In 1535, Charles V launched an extraordinarily large and ambitious expedition aimed at retaking Tunis. He drew soldiers and ships from all his vast possessions, including German Landsknechts and Spanish professionals, even caravels from allied Portugal and galleys from Genoa. When motivated and sufficiently planned, the Holy Roman Emperor could produce overwhelming force, and Tunis fell to him without much difficulty. It was a tremendous blow not only to Barbarossa, but also to Suleiman, and it was a major roadblock in their plans to put Charles's overstretched empire in strategic jeopardy. But the conflict was only just getting started. Suleiman turned a small portion of his empire's vast resources toward the task of creating a top-notch fleet for Barbarossa to lead. Soon, the corsair was ravaging Venetian possessions in the Adriatic and taking some of the last remnants of their island empire with a powerful Ottoman fleet. In 1538, Barbarossa crushed a combined Venetian, Papal, Spanish, and Genoese fleet at Preveza, destroying irreplaceable Christian ships and killing thousands of sailors and soldiers. That same year, Ottoman cavalry invaded and ravaged southern Italy. They were supposed to meet up with a French invasion from the north, but that never showed up. Charles retaliated by launching a full-scale assault on the port of Algiers in 1541. But broken up by storms and terrible coordination, the expedition proved to be a bloody debacle. Nobody had forgotten about Hungary either. Low-level fighting and raiding had continued to sweep across the kingdom in the years since Mohács, with occasional outbursts of much more intense fighting. An Ottoman army crushed a large force sent by Ferdinand to quell Ottoman raiding in 1537, killing thousands of Austrian, German, and Hungarian soldiers in the process. John Zápolya died in 1540 without an adult heir. Again, in classic Habsburg fashion, Ferdinand tried to seize the moment to further press his own claim to the throne, but he succeeded only in further rousing Suleiman's wrath. The Sultan decided to fully annex Hungary, and he besieged and captured Buda in 1541, then a series of border fortresses, 1542, 1543, and 1544. The expeditions Ferdinand and Charles V sent to retaliate achieved less than nothing. Negotiation was the only viable way forward, and it concluded with a humiliating peace treaty for the Habsburgs. They would pay an annual tribute to the Ottomans in return for a few scraps, the western and northernmost parts of Hungary. By 1547, when this peace treaty was signed, Suleiman had established himself as the greatest ruler in Europe and beyond. His lands stretched from the plains of Hungary to the shores of the Persian Gulf. He could snap his fingers and order naval campaigns from the port of Algiers, cavalry raids in northern Italy, or sieges in western Iran. Ottoman warships cruised off the east coast of Spain and the west coast of India. Tribute flowed into his coffers from Persia and Austria. The Sultan's treasury overflowed with surpluses that could be turned to the construction of mosques and palaces, the casting of siege guns, the building of warships, or any other purpose to which Suleiman set his mind. He was Suleiman the Magnificent, the Grand Turk, and he was just getting started. Next time on Tides of History, we'll continue our discussion of Suleiman's reign. Just like their European counterparts, the Ottomans were expanding outward into the rest of the world as participants in the Age of Exploration. On top of that, as much as Suleiman accomplished as a conqueror, he did much more as well. He codified laws, dealt with his family in the succession to the throne, and presided over a rapidly changing empire. The answers to our questions of transformation or decline will be found there, in the luxurious confines of the Sultan's palace and harem. Until then, thanks so much for joining me. Be sure and hit me up if you'd like to chat about anything we've talked about on Tides or something you'd like to see. You can find me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA. You can follow the show at Tides History. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening to this right now. If you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left a 5-star rating and a review. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. Sound design by Derek Behrens for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Leah Sutherland and Hernan Lopez. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.